Welcome to Street Smart Success. This is Roger Becker, your host. Cap rates on most real estate asset classes have dropped 40% over the past 5 years. This has made cash flow very hard to achieve. Ground-up construction, on the other hand, has much higher cap rates. The key is mitigating risk by being in the right markets with the right assets. Today's guest, Neil Bawa, the mad scientist of multifamily, has been doing ground-up construction in smaller markets in several different asset classes in order to generate attractive returns for investors. So today we have with us the mad scientist of multifamily, the founder of Multifamily U, a guy that has done and is doing just a multitude of incredibly great things. I'm super excited to have this gentleman with us. This is going to be fantastic. Neil Bawa, welcome to Street Smart Success.
Thanks for having me on, Roger. Super excited to be on the podcast.
Yeah, no, and you know, we had a nice little chat here before we hit the button. We've got some things in common, man. Part of, I guess, being here in the East Bay. I mean, I talk a little bit about people's background just for a minute because it's interesting and it sets the stage. I guess you went to school in Mumbai College. Is that where you were from originally?
That's right. Yeah. So I'm from Mumbai and technologist, nerd, came over from Mumbai directly to Fremont, California, which you know well because it's in the East Bay as well. And I've lived here ever since and gone through a crazy evolution, right? Started a technology company. It turned into a healthcare education company, ran that for 15 years, had a successful exit with a private equity firm from Chicago. And all along that process, became a little resentful of how much federal and California taxation was adding up to be. I felt like I was just working for the man and, you know, instead of working for myself. And that's really where the real estate journey started, because I realized the absolutely astonishing and unprecedented tax benefits that real estate offers to this day. In fact, they've gotten better since 2018.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in that top rung, you know, you're paying, including California, you know, 55% ish.
54.8%. I know that because I know that if I don't do something about that, 54.8% of my income is going to go, you know, to California and to the Fed. So I'm very pleased that I'm at the point where I'm paying almost no tax and not doing anything wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, the 54.8% is not cute for very long. So in Mumbai, what did your family do?
My dad died in the 71 war when I was a baby. My mom was a school teacher, did, you know, various odd jobs just to sort of bring us up. So we were very kind of lower middle class. My uncle's family was very rich. They had hotels and restaurants. And eventually, some of them moved here. And now they own, I think, 100 Burger Kings and Taco Bell. So I'm actually the only child of the family that didn't go into the food business. They kind of managed to get everybody else. They've got, you know, their clan. And so I get bored at holiday parties because I'm the one talking about technology and they're all talking about burgers.
Well, you know, that's amazing. So where are they based, the ones that own 100 Burger Kings and Taco Bells?
They're here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The Burger Kings, they go up all the way to Reno. So pretty much every Burger King that you hit from San Jose to Reno is owned by the family. So I'm, you know, I'm a passive investor with them. So
I find that to be absolutely fascinating. So here's a dumb gringo question. The 71 war was with Pakistan? What was that war?
Yeah, it more a conflict. So it was only about 30 days. My father was a fighter pilot and died in the war. So I never knew him. My mom remarried. So the man that I call my dad, you know, was actually my stepfather. They didn't tell me he was my stepfather until I grew up.
How old?
When I was told?
Yeah.
Well, I think 14, 15. Yeah.
Did you like him?
Very much so. Yes. Unfortunately, I've been unlucky twice in my life. I think our life is composed of key moments, the moments of extreme happiness and the moments of extreme sadness. He died in a scooter accident in Delhi on a day where there was a blackout. So many years, you know, after that 71 war, I was still a child. And so, but yeah, I remember him and there was astonishing amounts of love there. So even though I was a stepchild, he loved me more than my brother and sister from the same mom. And so I was always his favorite. So I got to enjoy a stepdad, and I didn't even know he was a stepdad.
Did you find out, by the way, accidentally when you were 14 or 15, or did they sit down and tell you?
Yeah, accidentally, because I you know, looked at pictures in a drawer, and there was this person with my mom, and clearly looked like they were getting married. And I was like, who the heck is this person? She was like, well, I was going to tell you when you were 16, but all right, sit down. You're the son of a fighter pilot.
And how old were you when your dad died?
I think I was 10. So, you know, he had died from a scooter accident when I was 10. I think those things shape you. Watching my mom struggle after that, struggling to put food on the table, but never giving up, you know, battling for her three children every day, really drove me. And I think, you know, I'm going to say something that they may not sound right, but you have to really think about the psychology of it. And that is that people who see distress early in their life are different. They're different from people who don't. And obviously it scars them. So there's downsides, but there's also, you know, upsides. And you see a lot of those people kind of being able to make a place for themselves in the world simply because they've seen adversity very early on. There was a time in our life where we would celebrate chicken because we could only afford chicken once a month, right? So it was the monthly chicken day. And yeah, I see how far I've come from that. And so I'm determined to do whatever I can for other people and make the world a better place.
So how old are you when your biological dad died?
I was 23 days old.
Whoa. Okay. Wow, man, that's heavy. You know what? You have no idea how much I'm tracking with what you're saying. And I try not to talk about myself because nobody really wants to hear that. It's about you, this podcast. My dad died when I was 6, and it put an arrow in my heart that will never go away. And it made me really, you know, I have a pretty thick skin. So, and yeah, I think a lot of the reasons that I've been able to attain success at what level it's been, I think, is because of exactly that. So I agree with you. Now, the thing that's so interesting, and then I as well watched my mom work to put food on the table for 4 kids. And, you know, we were, I'd say middle class. I don't want to be dramatic and say lower middle. She sold real estate, ironically, houses. And this is a long, long time ago in the Midwest. But here's something I have to ask is, like, so in India, however, with your mom, they don't, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they don't have, you know, the welfare system where you're on food stamps and they don't have assistance. Am I wrong? So in other words, your mom had, there was nothing handed out. She had to hustle and make it work. Is that correct?
No, there's no food stamp system at all. So there's no social net. And to this day, there is no social net. Now, because of a lack of social net, families tend to be more close-knit together. People do help. We were helped. So there's, you know, family sort of takes the place of a social net, but obviously, you know, not in terms of raw dollars.
I see. Yeah. And, you know, which is a whole other conversation about how entitled we are in this country. But that is very, very interesting. Okay. So, tell me then, and thanks for bearing with. This is a what a fantastic, interesting background. And I love what you said about extreme happiness and extreme sadness, defining moments. That's going to be our next podcast because that sounds very interesting. And I'd be curious to know who some of your people have influenced you. That sounds fascinating in and of itself. But so how did you get into real estate and maybe give me, you know, entry point? And, you know, clearly you said you were sick of paying, you know, 54.8% taxes.
Yeah, but that came later. So I got into real estate in reverse. So, right, most people start with a single family rental or they do a fix and flip, you know, private loans. I got into real estate absolutely in reverse. My first experience of real estate was when in 2003, our founder said, we're making lots of money. We do not want to be a landlord. We want to build a campus ourselves. And I was like, go, Paul, because I knew he was really good with construction and architecture design. I was like, go, Paul, let's build a campus. He's like, no, you build it. And I'm like, what the heck do I know about any of this stuff? I don't even have I haven't even rehabbed my kitchen. You want me to build a $6 million campus? He's like, no, I'm here. I'm going to help you. And of course he did, you know, he guided me in every way. And then, you know, we also hired other people to help. So it was an absolutely terrifying experience, Roger, because we were running a company growing at 30% a year with hundreds of employees. And at the same time, we were building a campus from scratch 3 miles away from our, you know, our previous location. And it was absolutely terrifying. And I learned an astonishing amount. And by the time I was done with that campus, it opened on July 4th, 2004. I think I was in love with real estate. I really enjoyed it. And subsequently, we went on to build 5 other campuses around California, you know, in as far-flung places as Sacramento. Most of them were in the San Francisco Bay Area. And every time I built them, I got better and better at it and really enjoyed that process. And because those campuses, we had put some of our own money in, for the first time, I heard about this thing called depreciation. And for the first time in 2005, my salary went up big time because that campus was huge and it was beautiful. I think you've been in that campus and it was gorgeous. And our competitors just couldn't compete with us because of us owning our own real estate and making it custom designed for our own use. So all of a sudden my salary goes up, Roger, and my taxes go down big time. So I'm like, what is this thing? What is this depreciation thing? So I started investigating that. And that sort of led me into real estate. And my timing was good because by the time, so I started collecting money because I wanted to not just buy one thing, I wanted to buy more. And so by the time I had the money and I was like, I'm ready to jump in, it was 2008. And everyone's telling me this is the worst time ever to jump into real estate. And I'm looking at that saying, what leads you to this conclusion? And they're like, well, look at prices, they're tanking. And I'm like, yes, isn't that good? And everyone's like, no, that's bad. And the mathematical side, you know, I'm a geek, I'm a dork. I mean, I look at this mathematically, I'm going, how could that be bad? So rents have not gone down anywhere in the United States that I can find. There's no evidence that rents have gone down. But now I can buy something for 30% of what I could buy 2 years ago, and that's bad? And people are like, yeah, you're going to be the biggest moron if you invest in real estate right now. And so it took me months of kind of taking that feedback from everybody and saying, I think you're all wrong. I think that you're all clueless. I basically decided I'm going to basically bet all of my money. This was 100% of the money that I had into basically proving how wrong people were. But because I was betting 100% of my money, I didn't just want to willy-nilly invest in some real estate. So I said, I'm going to go back to what I'm good at, which is research. I'm a dork, right? So I go, and there was this little website called Zillow that everyone knows now, and I pay a Ukrainian hacker to basically spider the website, and he comes back with a list of 400 cities. And we figure out the city in America that has had the maximum crash from 2005, because I read the Rich Dad Poor Dad book and it said, real estate, when it goes up too far. When it comes down too far. So I'm like, okay, which place in America did it come down the most? And luckily for me, the answer was it came down the most, 71%, in Madera, California, which is 144 miles from Fremont. It's near Fresno. Right. So you go into Central California and I'm like, so Madera, California, according to, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, is the place that has the most amount of opportunity. So instead of me just going around and buying whatever stuff appears on Zillow, I'm only going to buy in one place. I'm just going to buy in Madera, California, because my math says this place has dropped the most. That's where the opportunity is the greatest. So I jump in my car, I go off to Madera, California, and there I see these beautiful homes, Roger, brand new Kaufman and Broad homes with stonework outside, 4 and 5 bedrooms. Entire streets are empty. There's no one living there. But these homes, clearly no one has lived in them, right? So I go and talk to the brokers, like, why is there nobody here? And they're like, well, this Madera is surrounded by farmland. And so what Kaufman and Broad did and their brokers did in 2006, they collected a bunch of these people and said to them, hey, we're not checking your income. Why don't you buy these homes? They're all going to double. So those farmland workers ended up buying basically an entire section of Madera, completely brand new section of Madera. And they never really lived in them because they didn't, you know what to do with them. They weren't basically, they were just paying the interest-only numbers, which were pretty low. And so then in 2008, all those people vanished, right? Because the recession happened. And so now an entire section of Madera is empty. And so the broker also thinks that it's a stupid idea for me to basically be buying stuff because, you know, the entire street is empty. And I say, So what you're telling me is that I can buy these completely brand new homes for about $90,000. And he's like, yes. And the only reason that's bad is because I can't get tenants in them. He says, yes. So I said, what is the cost? What is the cost of building these homes? He's like, oh, well, $200,000. These are beautiful. So I'm like, so I can buy $200,000 homes for $90,000. And you're telling me that's a bad idea. It's like, yes, because you can't find the tenants. So I'm like, how the heck am I going to find tenants? And so this crazy idea comes to me when I'm sitting. This is late 2008. Crazy idea comes to me. And so I tell him, where is it easy to find tenants? He says Fresno, but Fresno's 21 miles away. So I say, okay, I'm going to jump in my car and drive to Fresno. So I drive another 21 miles, right? And I go to Fresno and I find a local broker there. And I say, can I buy like an old property in Fresno? Like, definitely don't want something new. He's like, no, I got plenty of like 2005 builds. And it's like, no. Sell me something that's old, like 1990s. So they sell me another property and it's like $90,000. And I buy that property. And it's on Summerfield Lane. And it's three bedrooms, not four or five like Madera. And so what I do then is I go back to the Ukrainian hacker and I say, this one property that I have on Summerfield in Fresno, can you get me tens of thousands or 10,000 leads for tenants? And he's like, why would you need so many, right? Probably need 50. I'm like, no, trust me. Here's some money. Give me a mountain of leads for this property. And so this guy, this Ukrainian hacker, goes and hacks all these websites like rent.com, Zillow.com, this.com, that.com, and basically sticks this home everywhere and refreshes the listings every hour on the hour using software. So my home is like at the top of everything. And so now I get buried under this massive avalanche of people that are looking to rent that one property. I have, you know, enough people to rent 20 or 50 of those. And so what I do is I go and hire a Philippine woman. So now I have 18 of these full-time Philippine employees, but back then she was the first one. I think her name was Janice. So I go to Janice and I say, Janice, you're going to take all these incoming phone calls from these people that are calling in about this property in Fresno and let them know, okay, that property is rented now, because it was, you know, I'd already rented it to somebody. But we have 10 other properties in Madera, 21 miles away. I'm going to send you the pictures. They are brand new. Nobody's ever lived in them. And they're $400 less than this crappy property in Fresno. And we're giving $50 Amazon gift card certificates to anyone that can drive from Fresno to Madera, right? 21 miles. And go check that home out. We'll give you $50, no questions asked. And most people would just hang up on her because they were like, this is some kind of stupid scam, right? These things are not real. And she's like, she would send emails with pictures of all of the properties. And there were 10 properties in Madera that I was interested in. I hadn't bought any of them yet. I basically told the bank what I'm looking to do. I'm looking to find tenants. Back then, you know, Roger, everything was melting down. The banks were friendly, right? So the banks were like, okay, so give us a deposit. So I gave them $5,000 deposits in each of them. I didn't actually purchase them. And so what we were trying to do was to see if we can get a contract signed. And the moment the contract would be signed, I'd go in and buy the property in cash. So every 50th person that speaks with Janice is like, so really, you want me to drive 20 miles to Madera when I'm asking for this Fresno property? And she's like, yeah, but these are beautiful homes. And, you know, it's only 20 minutes. There's no traffic on Highway 99. So every 50th person's like, let me just make $50. So they go there, they take their wife with them, they fall in love with these gorgeous places in Madera, and I get them all rented up. Every time I rent it up, I go in, I buy the property for $90,000 cash. I turn around. Now I have a lease signed. So I wait for a month and I refinance and I take basically 70% of $90,000 out, right? And I continue the process. 1 year later, I have 10 homes. They're all wildly profitable even then. But can you imagine the rents now? $2,300, $2,400 on homes that I bought for $90,000 each. I've refinanced them so many times, three times now, that I have $250,000 of equity that I've invested in other projects from those homes. All of it based on the concept that math is what really drives real estate. And the math was telling me that Madera, California was a shocking opportunity. Of course, later on, my family, who beat the shit out of me for doing all of this stuff, came around and then ended up buying lots of homes in Madera, California.
Do you still have those homes?
Yeah, I have everyone. I sold one because I needed some money, but the rest of them I just refinanced, because why would I sell something and recapture the depreciation? Roger, my problem is 50% tax. The moment I sell something, all the depreciation gets recaptured. So I don't sell anything. I just keep refinancing them. My homes actually are money providers, right? Because as their value goes up, I refinance them, I take the money out, I go invest that money somewhere else. So these homes are paid for themselves four times over, and that doesn't include any of the rents that I've made for the last 13 years.
I got it 100%. Well, what next?
Well, so I was doing that, and it was great. It was working out, right? So so by 2010, 2011, you know, I have a dozen of these homes. I'm doing really well. I'm feeling proud of what I'm doing. So I start talking with people about it. I put some blogs on the internet, and people are like, this is really cool stuff. You should open a meetup group. Because right then, meetup groups were, you know, brand new. Meetup.com was something that was a brand new website. And I'm like, I should open a meetup group. So I go to my boss, who's the CEO of the company, and I say, hey, we're a college, right? We have all these huge auditoriums. Do you mind if in the evening I open a meetup group in the college itself? So that way I don't have to travel to a meetup group and I can invite other meetup groups to come in and present. And the boss is like, only on one condition, I get to, you know, be in there with you as well so I can learn more real estate. I'm like, awesome. You're a great boss, Paul. So I open a meetup group inside of my business. And now various different meetup groups, fix and flip, you know, buy and hold, you know, lending, are coming and using my facilities because we have these beautiful classrooms for the meetup. Normally people are just, you know, doing them in offices, and here they have these beautiful, gorgeous classrooms. So we become pretty popular. Lots of real estate people start knowing me, and they're like, you should start your own meetup because you have these crazy math ideas. By this time, I've developed some really insane ideas, and they're called location magic now, and 50,000 people use them. But back then, these are just ideas, and I'm just throwing them at people saying, everyone should buy real estate using these ideas. And people are like, this is revolutionary, right? And today there's 50 people doing it, but I'm talking about 2010. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to start my own meetup. So together with some other people, I start my own meetup and I start teaching these ideas. And initially I'm like, you know, who's going to show up? These are like data ideas about real estate. These are like stuff that most people don't care about. And most parts of the US, Roger, five people would show up. But I was in Silicon Valley. There's geeks everywhere. Like, you know, you throw a rock, you're going to hit three dorks, right? So all these geeks, these dorks, these programmers start showing up at my events and they start understanding what I'm saying, because I'm saying things like, well, if a city's population grows at this rate and its home price grows at this rate and its income grows at that rate and its crime declines at this rate and its jobs grow at this rate, then this city is better than every other city. And you can rank it in this way. And they're like, dude, I get this stuff, right? I'm like, wow, these people are actually figuring this stuff out and they like what I'm saying. So before I know it, the meetup has hundreds of people showing up, right? I'm like a, you know, micro celebrity in the dork world, in Silicon Valley, right? It's like, there's this real estate guy. So now I start getting people calling me for podcasts. I've done 100+ podcasts. Then people start calling me at conferences and I stand up in the conference and people are like, that was a great presentation. We loved everything that you're doing. What are you selling? And I'm like, I'm not selling anything. I'm a technologist. I have a, you know, company to run. And I'm not, you know, I just do real estate for myself. I need to, you know, get my tax benefits. And every day people, Roger, are telling me, no, you should do this in real estate. And why are you only doing single family? All the math that you showed us, it applies better to multifamily and you can get even better depreciation there than single family. So I become curious about multifamily. So I invest $1 million in 10 syndications of other people. And those people start sending me these monthly newsletters and I start reading all the newsletters and asking questions. Like I become this nosy investor that basically says, what does this mean? What does that mean? What does this mean? What are these? You know, can you send me P&L statements and balance sheets and T12s? And they're like, what the heck? This guy is a passive investor. But they do it because they're obliged by law to do it. So I start figuring out all these things amongst 10 different syndicators that have $5 billion portfolios. And I'm learning all the stuff that they're doing because they're telling that stuff to their investors. And I'm an investor. I gave them $100,000. So before you know it, I started absorbing all these best practices. And I pivot my meetup to become a multifamily meetup. And I start teaching all those best practices. And everybody's okay with me teaching them because I tell them, look, I'm not a syndicator, right? I'm just like, these are 10 properties that I'm invested in, 3,000 units. And here's all the stuff that I'm learning. And they're okay with that because, you know, I have no pitch. I have nothing to sell. So now the meetup grows. And before we know it, there's 3,000 people and like hundreds are showing up. And then more people are calling me to conferences. And then I'm going to multifamily conferences and I don't even own a multifamily. So of course I fixed that. I start buying multifamilies in Madera and I start buying multifamilies in Chicago and other places. And, you know, it sort of snowballs from there. And these are the final, you know, this is 2012, 2013, and we're thinking of selling the property of the company. And I push the CEO, and he's also tired. He's 20 years older than I am. And so we sell the company in 2013. We get golden parachutes, so we hang around for a while. But we don't have much work to do because, you know, if you're in a golden parachute, they hire other people to replace you. Your job is to just keep an eye on them, not necessarily to do things themselves. So I'm basically doing real estate full-time with the blessing of this private equity company that's bought our company, and I'm pivoting and I'm basically going into multifamily, and boom, from there onwards, things just sort of snowballed. And here I am, 2021. We have a $500 million portfolio, 23 projects, 10 states, with 30 employees and about 100 employees at the properties. About 550 investors are invested with us. And this year we're going to hand out about $10 million in profits. It sort of all just snowballed from there. So that system that I designed, eventually I basically created a course for it and I started giving that course away. So it was a 2-hour course that basically uses data analytics to figure out the best cities in America to invest in. And, you know, people were using it. There were maybe 50, 100 people a month using it. And then one of the geeks comes up to me and say, this is the wrong way. You shouldn't be using Meetup to give away your course. You know, you should be using it online. So I'm like, so which website should I use? And he says, there's a website called Udemy, U-D-E-M-Y, which was much smaller back then. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go stick my 2-hour video course on Udemy. And it just explodes. Like, there's 8,000 students taking the course right now. It's the most popular real estate course on Udemy. So if you go, just type U-D-E-M-Y space Neil Bawa, N-E-A-L Bawa, and you'll see the course. You'll see hundreds of 5-star reviews because there's no pitch. You know, I don't say anything in the course about my properties. I'm like, here's how you can figure out these amazing cities that nobody's ever heard of, like Madera, California. It's not the best place to invest in, by the way. So don't do that because cities change over time. So Madera is done in its cycle, right? But today, the best city in America to invest in, according to those toolkits, are places like Idaho Falls, Idaho. You know, there's Dayton in Georgia. There's Destin in Florida. There's St. George in Utah. There's Logan in Utah. These are tiny cities that nobody's ever heard of. But the speed at which their real estate grows beats the crap out of Phoenix or the San Francisco Bay Area. You double or triple your money so much faster. So, I mean, that's kind of the long story of my journey.
So there's so many things I could ask, and kudos to how you've done this. It's like been really organic. I guess my question is, in those places like, Destin or Idaho Falls, how do you, you know, with a smaller pool of people, how do you deal with the management, the day-to-day, you know, grind on site?
Yeah. So the answer is, it's the primary challenge, right? But let's talk about who's listening to this podcast, right? So there's people like me that are doing hundreds of units, right? So now we do as many as 300 units when we do apartments. And by the way, I do other things, self-storage, industrial, student housing. I do all kinds of things. You know, I'm an experimenter, right? So I need to tinker with stuff all the time. But let's say that people are listening who want to have, you know, 10 units or 4 units in Idaho Falls. Idaho Falls is no different from any other place. There's great property managers for managing 4 units or 10 units. What Idaho Falls sucks at are great property managers for managing 100 or 200 units. That's where you're going to run into trouble because they don't have that scale. So it really depends on who you are. I wouldn't suggest a lot of folks go in there. Now, how did I fix that problem? Because I do have, you know, these large units. Well, I hired an army in the Philippines and full-time asset managers in the US that direct those armies. So we have our own call center. We have people, thousands of, you know, we generate our own leads. We keep an eye on the property manager. We've got back-end people checking everything that the property manager is doing. So we're essentially getting around the problem of there not being scaled enterprise level property managers in places like Idaho Falls or Logan, Utah. So we invented our own way of getting around it. for the hard work of inventing that workaround, we now get to invest in crazy markets. Let me give you an example. In Idaho Falls, in the last 12 months, home prices went up 34%, right? Which means rents in Idaho Falls this year, it takes a year for rents to kind of go up once home prices go up. Rents will go up somewhere around 13%. So 13 to 14%. Rents go up about 40% of home prices. So if it's, you know, 34%, then you take 40% of that, you're basically at 13 or 14% rent growth. 14% rent growth is an astonishing number. Because in the US over the last 50 years, rents have grown at 2 to 3% a year. 14% means you hit your five-year pro forma in a year, right? You can't get that in super large cities. The San Francisco Bay Area only had about 3% rent growth in the last 12 months. Prices did go up here for single-family homes, but they went down for multifamily. So overall, you know, rents weren't up by much. And there are a few big markets where rents went up aggressively, but these smaller markets will always beat the bigger ones because they grow much faster. And of course, COVID has had a remarkable effect on these far-off markets simply because now there are people moving there that feel free. They feel like they're liberated. So, you know, the population growth in these markets is absolutely astonishing. So that's really my premise. I'm really not hot on investing in superstar markets. I haven't invested in California at all, right? California has the biggest superstar markets. I haven't invested in New York. I invest in these little places. I invest in places like Jacksonville. I wouldn't invest in Miami. I don't invest in Atlanta, but I invest in Fayetteville. That's 35 miles away from Atlanta. Or Dalton, Georgia. That's 85 miles away from Atlanta. So I still benefit from the halo of Atlanta's amazing economy, but I don't have to pay Atlanta's crazy prices.
It seems to me just at, you know, at kind of arm's length that in the last year, loosely, you're doing more ground up stuff. Is that just my observation or is there some truth to that?
Completely true. And multiple reasons. Since COVID started, and even before COVID, but it's massively accelerated by COVID, the market has become irrational for existing product. So 5 years ago, you would pay something like 7 cap, 7.5 cap for a 40-year-old property. Then that, you know, 7 cap simply means you're paying a certain amount. Then it became 6 cap, which means you were paying about 15-20%. Then it became 5 cap. Post-COVID, you're paying 4 cap. With basically, which means no cash flow, just so for those of you that don't understand cap rates, you know, no cash flow on a 40-year-old property. But when I construct a property from scratch, and that's how I started, remember my story of building the campus with the CEO's blessing and you know, oversight. When I constructed to 7 cap. So now I'm getting 2015 prices on a brand new property. Even in 2015, I was paying a lot more for that brand new property, but at least I had the option of buying a 40-year-old property at 7 cap. Today, everything is 4 cap. It's astonishingly expensive. So in an astonishingly expensive world, isn't it better to pay an astonishing amount of money for land? Because land is only about 5, 6, 7% of your cost. So I'm still paying up for land. I'm still getting ripped off, but only on 7% of the project. For the rest of it, I'm the one ripping off whoever's buying it.
Yeah, I figured as much. And so what are you doing ground up these days? I know you're doing fourplexes. I think in Houston looks like a great sub market, like in a medical area. What else are you doing ground up?
So yeah, that's right. The Houston ones are both next to the Texas Medical Center, which is the largest medical center on planet Earth. But they also happen to be 3/4 of a mile from the university. So it's actually a hybrid market where we're 2.5, 3 miles from the largest medical center on planet Earth and less than a mile away from the university. But to answer your questions, you know, I built apartment complexes. So we're building more than 500 units in suburbs of Phoenix. Once again, not Phoenix, but suburbs of Phoenix, places like Mesa and Avondale, places you haven't heard of. And I'm very thankful that not enough people have heard of Mesa and Avondale. Rents went up 17% last year in Mesa, and they went up 20% in Avondale, which are crazy numbers, right? Absolutely nuts numbers. So I love building apartments and I'm going to keep building them. But here's what I found. The problem with apartments. So single family has, you know, the obvious problems of not having scale. You have a unit, you know, you lose your tenant. All of a sudden your income goes down to 100. You still need to pay your mortgage. With multifamily, even if you, you know, have a 250 unit and you lose 10 tenants, you've only lost 4% of your profits. And, you know, you have on-site management, you have on-site staff. You're not getting ripped off by some third party charging you $125 an hour. So most people know the huge benefits of multifamily, but, and the downside of single family, but there's downsides of multifamily too, which are not as known. Number one, you only get loans for 10 years. So after 10 years, you have to start the loans again. The loans are really expensive. Paying them off early costs millions of dollars, right? So there's downsides of multifamily. And also, multifamily loans are generally more expensive than, you know, if you want to lock in a rate, generally more expensive than single family. So I started doing research and said, what's the sweet spot? And the sweet spot is fourplexes. Because a fourplex is four units. So if you lose a tenant, you're still at 75% occupancy. So you've got that benefit of multifamily. You've got some scale. But then on the other hand, you're getting single family financing. Spend a few thousand dollars, refinance wherever the heck you want. There's no early termination. You can lock in for 30 years. And you still have, you know, depreciation coming in from four units. So you've got all of the financing benefits of single family. And you've got some of the scale benefits of multifamily. Some, not all. So I was like, this is nice, but it's not far enough. I want all the benefits of multifamily. I want the benefits of scale. I want an on-site property manager. I want an on-site maintenance person. But I still want people to be able to buy their own fourplexes so they can keep them forever. So the idea I came up with, which I think eventually will become very popular in the US, is build a 100-unit community of fourplexes and plat them individually, which is pretty hard, so that everyone owns their own fourplexes. So there's 25 Rogers that are investors in this project. They all own their own fourplex, but it's being run as an institutional fourplex with a clubhouse, a pool, swimming pool, a property manager that works there full time, and a leasing agent and a maintenance person. So you get all of the benefits of multifamily, all of the benefits of scale. You get all the benefits of cost segregation and depreciation and bonus depreciation, but everyone still owns their own fourplex and they can decide when they want to sell. So it took me forever to come up with a legal structure that was appropriate for that, but that's what we're doing now. And our investors absolutely adore it. They do not want us to go back because they're like, so even though I own just four units, there's a property manager full-time at the property and I can pick up the phone as an owner anytime and that property manager will be at the site 9 to 5 every single day? Yes. And I have a maintenance person that I'm only paying $22 an hour that's basically just running around my property and doesn't work anywhere else? Yes. And I get all of those benefits and I still have 100% ownership.
So Neil, this 100 units, 25 owners, let's say, are you saying that they've got one property manager? They have one, you know, they have a, basically it's managed by one entity. There's, let's say, one leasing agent. There's one maintenance for everybody. Is that the way it works?
Yes, because that's the benefit, right?
Yeah, no, I get it.
I mean, that maintenance person is being paid $22 an hour. And for $22 an hour, they're going around doing everything at the property for the next, you know, 2 decades, right? And when that person doesn't work, the property manager fires that person, hires a new person. So you get that huge scale benefit of 150 units, but you only own four.
Are any of those, and it does sound ingenious, by the way, are any of those done? Or are they still in various?
Yeah. So University Oaks in Houston is done. So I don't have a project in Houston. I have two. So okay. You may have seen the one that's still in construction, but University Oaks is done. The first phase is almost complete. So it's complete at this point in time. And then there's a second phase coming along. And then there's one in Idaho Falls, which will be leasing up in the coming 3 months. So there'll be a lease up happening.
Right. Super cool. So the University Oaks, what did a fourplex cost, I guess, the first section?
Those are about, I think, somewhere around $1.4 million because they're very upscale. So we build Class A product, Class A plus, and we also build B and then B minus. So those cost, you know, in Idaho Falls, they cost less than $250,000 because they were B, maybe even B minus. Townhomes. These were A pluses because that market supports it and it's most profitable to own A plus product. So it was $1.4 million for four of them. Nidaho Falls, less than a million for four.
And so the ones in Houston, University Oaks, what approximately are the rents on those units?
$2,350 for each unit. So your rents are about $9,700,
$9,800 a month. Got it. Right on, man. You are, if nothing else, you are an entrepreneur and grass does not grow under your feet. And so when you say you're in self-storage, I think you said industrial. I guess if you like looking over the next, you know, however you want to define it, but 12, 24, 36 months, where do you think the bulk of your emphasis is going to be?
On the fourplex product, because I find that it serves investors and syndicators the best. Apartments, in my mind, serve syndicators better than investors. Investors make money, so that's great. But they, when you sell that apartment complex 3 or 4 years after you built it, all that depreciation benefit that you gave to the investors, you're going to recapture it. So now the investors are saving all this money. Now they're forced to take all of that money and immediately invest it into another property so they can get some more depreciation back. With fourplexes, I'm hoping my investors never sell them, so they can get 30 years of depreciation with no recapture because they own it, right? So you have 100% control with professional property management that costs less than the property management you would have paid for if you had a fourplex yourself because of the fact that that property manager and the leasing agent and the maintenance person are shared amongst 25 fourplexes all on the same lot. So the efficiency of scale means that you're paying less. So when people see this, we have an infinite amount of demand. We can't build them quickly enough. And I'm really not looking to become a dot-com person and scale to hundreds of millions. So we're doing two projects at a time. And we're happy with those two. That's it. I mean, we're not going faster. We're not looking to scale up and hire 100 people.
Is the property management on site or is it third party?
It's a third party property management company that has an on-site property manager that's dedicated to the property. So the property manager and the maintenance staff work at the property full time, don't work anywhere else, but they report up to a third-party property management company because how can I know what the appropriate rents are going to be in Idaho Falls, Houston, Austin, and 50 other places? So you get a property manager that's managing 50,000 units. They've got CFOs, they've got accountants, they have the ability to break up a 100-unit property into 25 packages and send those out to you every month. So you get that scale benefit, right? But the biggest benefit really comes because the property is big enough to pay for an on-site property manager and on-site maintenance, because that's where your efficiency comes.
Wow, man. So you are rocking and rolling. So what would you say, Neil, you've made clearly some very, very smart, strategic, thoughtful moves for the last, I'm going to say, 15 or so years. What mistakes have you made? You know, what have you learned? What
your biggest? I think that's certainly a big one. So very early in my career, I took ideas that I had from Madera and I implemented them in other metros like Chicago, like South Chicago. And I found that the ideas don't transfer from one metro to another. Every metro is by itself. I also made a mistake in South Chicago of basing my purchases on future events, which were going to happen. Everybody thought they were going to happen, right? So I had 100% belief that they were going to happen. They did happen, in fact. So I bought a property near the site of the Obama Presidential Library in South Chicago. But the Friends of Jackson Park sued the Obama Presidential Library team, and the library was delayed for 4 years. So we had a project that did very poorly because of that lawsuit, not allowing the Obama Presidential Library to proceed and basically bleeding us of money for 4 years. So what I learned from that was simply this: do not buy properties with other people's money using events that you know are going to happen because they could get delayed. They're not in your control. They could get delayed. Again, not your fault. You're not doing anything wrong, but they could get delayed. So you have to buy a property based on how it is that day as opposed to how it will be in the future. And yes, when you do that, you give up a lot of profit, but it's worthwhile giving it up.
Yeah, those are words of wisdom. You know, you talk a lot. You talk about the irrationality of multifamily right now, and everything is kind of on the come. You know, you're buying against tomorrow's value, not on today's value, and so therefore, it's virtually speculation.
It is, and I'm happy to be on the other side of it. when the market is filled with speculators, go from being a buyer to being a seller.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So Neil,
I've been building for the last 3 or 4 years because of that. And you asked me about storage and industrial. I definitely want to do more industrial projects. I think storage is a good market, but industrial is an amazing market.
Why?
One very simple reason. COVID accelerated e-commerce by 2 decades. If you look at the growth of e-commerce, today the market share of e-commerce, you know, post-COVID or, you know, almost at the end of COVID, is what it would have been about 15, 16 years from now, if you look at the straight line growth of e-commerce. So we got 15, 16 years of e-commerce growth without ever building the warehousing and logistics infrastructure, because how much of that could be built in the last 12 months? So at this point, industrial is at an astonishing opportunity for the next 5 years, because you know, e-commerce growth didn't slow down even after COVID. I mean, it's staying at that level. It's plateaued, but it's staying at this amazing level that we had expected it to be at 10, 15 years from now. And we never built the infrastructure. So I think e-commerce is even a better opportunity than multifamily, because I can't say that the population of the United States grew 15% over the last year. It grew at less than 1%, right? But the e-commerce requirements of the US grew 15, 20, well, actually more than that. In the last 12 months, and it's now staying at that new level.
And, you know, you talk about irrational, et cetera, you know, the cap rates, the same thing has happened in industrial. So are you thinking mostly, I shouldn't have framed the question that way, but I did. So are you thinking mostly ground up?
I'm doing ground up but not necessarily because it's irrational, because still, you know, industrial cap rates are higher than multifamily, which means that you get more bang for your dollar. But the reason I'm doing construction in industrial is industrial construction is much simpler and in some ways less risky, because you're not using lumber or timber. These days, as you know, lumber prices are completely insane. They go up and down for no reason whatsoever. So that's risk. But with industrial, you use tilt-up concrete, which has, you know, gone up maybe 10%. You know, lumber went up 400% briefly earlier in the year. Tilt-up concrete is also much faster. So, you know, you can build a building from scratch in about 8 months. No one's ever built a multifamily in 8 months.
Do you have any in process right now where you've broken ground?
Well, yes. And so we've broken ground, we've built them, we've sold them, and now we're building more on the same project. So it's a phased project. So we build them, we sell them, and we take the profits and we roll them over into the next set of buildings.
I see.
So my industrial projects are in the past, present, and future because of the phasing.
In what market?
Salt Lake City.
You got a lot of stuff going on. Well, that's phenomenal. I am so glad we closed the loop here and had this conversation. I'm sure there are multiple ways to get a hold of Neil Bawa, but what would you suggest?
The easiest way to get a hold of me is to type N-E-A-L, Neil, Bawa into Google. I'm the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. So if you want to find trash on me, that's also very easy to find, because they're all talking about Neil Bawa. I haven't come across any trash yet, but it's inevitable. If you're successful, somebody's going to trash talk you. But Neil Bawa, N-E-A-L-B-A-W-A, just hit it in Google.
Well, I guess we'll know. The way we're going to know that you've gotten really, really successful is when there's people talking trash about you.
Yep, yeah, that's right. I believe that.
Neil, I appreciate it. This has been a fantastic conversation. I've looked forward to it. And what can I say, man? My hat's off to everything you've done and are doing.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate you. And thank you for having me on the podcast.
You got it. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.